Okay, everyone. This is Nicole Korkolis at the International, and I want to thank everybody so much for taking time to join us today for this important webinar, the public employee sector. We realize that all of you on the phone represent people in the public sector, whether it's the majority or a small part of your membership, that you understand the challenges that we're facing today and those that are poised and ready to come down the road very soon. You will also understand how these issues, whether it's national right to work, legislation, fair share fee cases, such as Friedrich's that have been and will soon be before the Supreme Court, you understand what a huge impact they're going to have on us and the entire labor movement and our ability to represent people. So today we gathered some folks together who are well-versed on the subject and who can not only lay out these challenges but help us develop a strategic plan of action to meet them. So I've asked a few people to be with us to lead the discussion, and I'm going to introduce them as we go through the next hour. But first, I want to review a few technical things about the webinar. We're happy to say that most of our local unions who represent employees in the public sector are on the phone today, so that's quite a few. So with the large number of participants, we're going to ask that you all please do keep your phones muted so that we can avoid any background noises and feedback. And I know the announcer said that if you want to unmute your mic, you could. Please don't do that. We'd appreciate if you could just keep it muted. If you have a question, we want to hear it. There's going to be opportunities throughout for Q&A. If you notice on your screen next to the slides, there is a box that says Q&A. That's where you type your questions. So go ahead and please, any time throughout the hour, you can type them in. We're going to get to as many as we possibly can, but we are going to be cognizant of your time, and we want to try and end on time. So if we don't get all the questions in, please, we'll get back to you, we'll email you, we'll call you, you call me. Don't feel like we're not going to get to them. We want to get to them. So that's really it technically. The last thing, we're going to send you the PowerPoint. So don't feel like you have to write everything down as we're going along that's on the screen. You're going to have this in your email as soon as we're finished. So the first thing we're going to do today is we're going to look at OPIU specifically and where we are in the public sector and how this, all of the things that we're going to talk about today are going to impact us directly. So I'm going to turn things over to OPIU's Director of Organizing, Cindy Hsu. A lot of you know her. She is new to the International, but not new to OPIU. You know she's been with Local 8 for many years. So we're very happy to have her here at the International, and we're thrilled to have her on the phone. So I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to Cindy Hsu.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. So most OPIU local unions participated in the organizing survey that was conducted last year, and that really helped to provide an accurate description of our membership composition. So with your participation, we learned that we have close to 17,000 public sector members, and that represents about 16% of our membership of about 103,000 members. So, of course, the erosion of public employee rights extends far beyond this 16% shown in this pie chart and impacts all of our members in our community, as we'll be talking about later on. So this is a really stark and unsettling visual of how right-to-work laws have impacted the landscape of our country. And, of course, the shaded red area represents those states with right-to-work laws. There are now 28 right-to-work states, with Missouri the latest casualty just last month. The small blue dots that you see represent OPEIU locals, and there's some green dots up in Canada. Those are guilds or DAGs, directly affiliated groups, and there's some yellow dots, too, that represent guilds. But we've got about 85 local unions, and as you know, many of those local unions have a large number of public employees. So there are more than twice as many OPIU public employee members that are in non-right-to-work states. So that's 12,000 public employees in non-right-to-work states. So those folks are especially need to be prepared to face this potential, but not inevitable, membership decline. So there's no doubt that right to work has really impacted overall union membership, which is now hovering at about 10.7%, or about 14.6 million working people. And those of you who are around 30 years ago know that that number used to be closer to, in 1983, was 20%. So there's no doubt that union membership is declining. Keep in mind that public sector union membership, the rate is about 34%. So that's more than five times higher than private sector workers, which is only 6.4%. So 34%, nearly 35%, of public sector employees are now in a union. So there's a lot at stake here. So where do OPIU member employees work? So our members work in city and county and state government, public district hospitals, public housing authorities, public transportation authorities, utilities, and then there are other public or quasi-public entities in education, mental health. So some of these quasi-public entities, they vary from state to state, and they're a hybrid of city, county, and other municipal regulations, and you know, have a variety of funds. So I know I'm certain that I don't have to convince any of you of the devastating impact that these anti-worker laws have on our livelihood, our health, our safety, our ability to retire and provide education for our children, for our overall well-being. If you're interested in delving a little further to get some good facts, you can go to the link provided here at the AFL-CIO to learn more. There's some really good source information. And also the Economic Policy Institute has lots of information about the impact of right to work. So I'll just conclude my brief remarks with acknowledging that, yes, we certainly are in challenging times. But a massive decline in membership isn't inevitable, regardless of what, you know, whatever nasty laws and decisions are thrown at us, and we'll be talking about that in just a minute. We really can survive, but to make a difference, it's going to take renewed and urgent recommitment to organizing and to really tapping into the potential power of our 100,000 plus members. So we'll be talking about later on in the webinar about how we do that. So for now, let's take a look at our current environment.
Thank you, Cindy. So far, I don't see any questions, so we'll keep things moving. Like I said, if you do, just text them in the Q&A section, and we'll address them. As Cindy said, we're going to turn things over now to Jane Lauer Barker. She is an attorney with PITA LLP here in New York, and she works with OPIU on a lot of issues, and she's going to now give us an overview of the current legal environment. You know, we've heard about the big one, we've heard about Friedrichs, but there are a lot of other cases pending that are going to have an impact on us, and she's going to look at those and the different opposition forces that we can expect in the near future. So we'll go ahead and turn it over to Jane.
Okay, thank you. All right, the starting point of any discussion about fair share fees in the public sector is the Supreme Court's decision in Abood versus the Detroit Board of Education. That was the case in which the Supreme Court upheld agency fees or fair share agreements in the public sector. And the court in that decision relied upon, as the basis for upholding those, the cases that came out of the court under the Railway Labor Act, the private sector. And they held that it was based upon the desirability of labor peace and avoiding labor unrest and remedying the problem of free riders that fair share agreements were acceptable. They did, however, confirm, as we know, that dissenting members cannot be required to pay for the political activities of unions. That decision was challenged in the case of Harris v. Quinn. And there the court, that was a decision by Justice Samuel Alito, who has seems to have a special interest in this area, And he made a lot of statements in there casting serious doubt on whether he considered Abood to be good law anymore, and gave many of us the impression that he would be prepared in the proper case to overrule Abood. But the court, written by him, that decision determined that it wasn't necessary at that time. So the Harris decision was, however, a 5-4 decision. Then in last term of the Supreme Court, the court again faced the constitutionality of public sector agency fees in a case, Friedrichs versus CTA. That case moved quickly to the Supreme Court out of the Ninth Circuit in California. And, however, before it could be decided, Justice Antonin Scalia passed away, which left the court with 8 members. The court split 4-4, and when the court is evenly split, the decision of the court below remains standing. So the Ninth Circuit had recognized Abood as being the law, and therefore fair share agreements in the public sector remain good law at this point in time. There is a the Harris v. Quinn, just a side note about Harris v. Quinn. I'm not sure. It looks like most of the public sector members in OPIU are direct employees of state or local government or political subdivision. Harris v. Quinn, however, because of the language of Justice Scalia, Justice Alito, criticizing Abood, dealt with the home care workers who were not considered to be full-fledged public employees. They were generally worked for relatives. Many of them worked for relatives, and they were only considered home care. They were only considered state employees by virtue of the state law, which said they can organize themselves and be members of a union. So they were covered by the state labor law, but essentially the customer or the client was responsible for most of their terms and conditions of employment. As a result, the court in Harris v. Quinn found that Abood's rationale for permitting fair share fees did not apply to the Harris v. Quinn employees, and therefore they were impermissible under the First Amendment as applied to employees who are not considered full-fledged public employees. I'm going to skip over the private sector, but I think you'll be getting a copy of the PowerPoint so you can look at that yourself. So just to summarize that, there, fair share fees are currently permissible in both the public and private sector, and the Supreme Court has at this point only created a distinction for non-full-fledged public employees who cannot be charged fair share fees. At the same time, however, the court seriously questioned the validity and the principles upon which the Abood case rested. There have been a number of cases, apart from the issue of whether dissenting members can be charged fair share fees or agency fees, challenging the basic exclusive representation principle, meaning the obligation for the employees who are covered by a collective bargaining agreement to join the union. And apart from having to pay the agency fees, but just having to be represented by the union. In 1984, the Supreme Court held that exclusive representation by a democratically selected union does not, without more, violate the right of free association on the part of the dissenting non-union members of the bargaining unit. And that has been the law ever since that case. The interesting thing about that case is that the Supreme Court, there were two aspects of the challenge in that case. One was to the rule that was promulgated by Minnesota that the exclusive representative of these college instructors were endowed with the right to bargain over the terms and conditions of employment, and they had the exclusive right to meet and confer with the college administration about issues that were not mandatory subjects of bargaining. Those issues were decided in different opinions by the Supreme Court. The exclusive representation for purposes of collective bargaining terms and conditions was summarily affirmed. The lower court's decision was summarily affirmed by the Supreme Court based upon Abood only. They did not address that. They did not really discuss it, but they affirmed the district court's opinion based upon Abood. As to the meet and confer requirements that state law provided or created for the union in that case, the Supreme Court wrote a long decision and basically affirmed the exclusive representation principle and said that the meet and confer part of that was also not a violation of the First Amendment rights of that bargaining unit, because under that law, the bargaining unit members were free to themselves communicate with college administration on any issues that they like, and they had the right to speak even against the positions that were taken by the union. So the court found that there was no infringement on their First Amendment rights simply by being represented by the union. The a subsequent case is D'Agostino v. Baker. That was a First Circuit in, I think it was Massachusetts case. That was an interesting decision for lawyers because Justice Souter, who was formerly a U.S. Supreme Court justice and who retired and went back to his home in Vermont, still sits as a designated judge on the Court of Appeals in the First Circuit. And he wrote this decision, and he had no problem in finding that the Knight case applied to child care providers, and there was no infringement of their First Amendment rights by the exclusive representation authorization that was enacted by the state of Massachusetts in that case. That the plaintiffs in that case did try to reach the Supreme Court by filing a petition for certiorari, which is the way you get to the Supreme Court. That was denied last June. So that kind of lays out where we are in terms of the current state of the law. We now need to think about what's going to happen going forward. And, of course, there are a wide range of organizations that are allied in a effort to undermine the rights of workers, including their rights to be represented by unions and the ability of unions to represent them. And these are a little list of them. I'm sure you know more from your own experience. So addressing first the next upcoming situation for fair share fees, the case that is most likely to reach the Supreme Court is Janus v. AFSCME. That comes out of Illinois. It was a challenge to fair share obligations under Illinois state law applicable to all public employees of the state of Illinois. It's kind of a convoluted case because the case was originally brought by the governor of Illinois, who was a Republican at the time, and then he was found not to have standing. The governor had no standing, meaning he didn't have a personal interest in whether the fair share agreements were upheld or not. So the court, so someone intervened, an employee and a member who was an objector to paying the fair share fees. And it was argued before the, in that form, it was argued before the Seventh Circuit on March 1st. The court understood that the defenders of the fair share fees were basically relying on Abood. And as long as Abood is the law of this country, that decision, the right of the unions to obtain fair share fees would have to proceed to the Supreme Court. I just checked the docket in the Seventh Circuit today, and they haven't yet rendered a decision. There were some procedural issues present in that case because the individual member had intervened after the case was started, and the union was claiming that they were not properly before the court, and they couldn't intervene and take the place of the governor, and that the case should be dismissed for that reason. It didn't sound, I listened to the argument, it did not sound like the court was very convinced by that, but it was a point that union had to make, obviously, because if this case goes to the Supreme Court, they will want to be able to suggest to the Supreme Court that there's some procedural problem with the case and it should not be decided by the Supreme Court. But I think, you know, we'll see a decision very shortly from the Seventh Circuit, which will state the obvious that the Abood decision is still good law and the fair share fee provision of Illinois state law must stand. Now, if that comes out shortly, I'll go through sort of the Supreme Court cycle in a bit, but I would expect that it could be decided by the Supreme Court if they take the case sometime before the end of June next year. But the key, of course, here is that we do not yet have a ninth Supreme Court justice. It appears like Justice Scalia would have been interested in overruling the fair share agreements and overturn Abood. So at this point, we're faced with the possibility of the next justice being also a very conservative justice, such as the one that's been nominated by President Trump. And that if he is confirmed, it's likely that could spell the end of agency fees in the public sector. There also are cases percolating through the court system involving the use of opt-outs as opposed to opt-ins for dissenting members. The Supreme Court could elect to hear a case concerning mandatory opt-out systems. There is one which is coming out of the state of Washington, which requires individuals to opt out, and that was found to be constitutional by the court, but that's in the pipeline also and may make it to the Supreme Court. Then, of course, there's the issue of whether unions will be liable for dues collected from the public employees who are not full-fledged public employees. In both the Hoffman case, which is cited on this page, and the case that came out of New York State, Jarvis v. Cuomo, the issue was decided in favor of the unions, meaning that the unions were not required to reimburse the dissenting members for dues that had been deducted prior to the decisions which invalidated those dues, as in the Harris v. Quinn decision. So those cases, Huffman v. Inslee, I'm not sure. We haven't seen any development that might be close to being taken to the Supreme Court. Jarvis v. Cuomo was very close, and the Supreme Court denied certiorari in Jarvis in March. again, I'm not going to talk too much about the private sector, but there is a major bill that's pending, was introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives by two Republican representatives. It's called the National Right to Work Act, and that would eliminate the ability to require any payment as a condition of employment. That would affect the private sector. Jarvis v. Cuomo, as I just mentioned, is was denied cert on February 27th. So the exclusive representation issue is not yet ready to be taken up by the Supreme Court. It's you never really know why the Supreme Court doesn't accept a case that is presented to it for on a petition for certiorari. It may well be that this exclusive representation case is something that they consider to be an issue dealt with after they address the fair share fee arrangements, because this one does raise more difficult questions. The issue of whether just by virtue of being represented by a union, your First Amendment rights have been abridged is not one that would be really clear from serious doubt. It's very questionable, and some of the language in other decisions that were decided in favor of exclusive representation indicate that that would really be quite a step forward, and I'm not sure that the court could find five justices that would overrule that. But those cases are definitely in process, and we are likely to see that issue go before the Supreme Court at some point in the next few years. This case is on appeal to the Ninth Circuit, Bain v. CTA, California Teachers Association, in which the non-member teachers are challenging union internal restrictions on their voting rights and employment-related benefits. So that's another one that we need to keep our eyes on. Okay, just a little discussion of the U.S. Supreme Court and what we can expect and when. The court hears cases from October to June or July, and they decide what cases they're going to hear during that period as well. A case is added to the Supreme Court's calendar or docket if four judges agree to accept the case. The steps in order to get a case to the Supreme Court are that a writ of certiorari must be filed by a party telling the court why it should hear the case within 90 days after the entry of judgment in the lower court. So, for example, in the case that's coming out of the Seventh Circuit, Janice v. Asme, if that case is decided soon, if the decision is rendered, you know, within March or something like that, it's possible by the fall, the Supreme Court will decide whether to take that case. There's an opposition brief after the writ is filed. That's filed within 30 days. And if accepted by the court, then there's a briefing schedule for the merits of the case, in which event after the briefs are filed, there will be oral arguments sometime between April and May. There's a judges' conference like a week after the oral argument is heard, and then whoever is in the majority, the senior judge in the majority, will assign the case to one of the judges to write the opinion. And this is a summary of the current members of the court. We basically at this point in time have a 4-4 split. As I mentioned, Justice Alito has shown a very strong interest in the fair share fee cases, and his language indicates that he He is not enamored with fair share fees, and he is much more a proponent of extending First Amendment rights to those, and sort of in derogation of the labor peace and the free rider arguments that were used to support those decisions.
Okay.
And that's all I have.
Thank you very much, Jane. That's a lot. We're questions are starting to come in, but we're going to hold them until the end. Now that we kind of have a clearer picture of what we're up against, it seems a little overwhelming, but there are things that we can do, and we can use the experiences of people who have kind of been tackling this in the past and look at what they've been doing and put together a strategy. So I'd like to introduce Kim Cook. She is with the Worker Institute at Cornell University, and she has a great deal of experience in this area. And so we're going to turn it over to Kim to talk about, you know, what we can do now. So Kim Cook.
Great. Thanks, Nicole. Hi, everybody. As Nicole said, my name is Kim, and I'm currently in New York City at the Cornell Worker Institute. But I spent most of my union life in Washington State at SEIU Local 925. And at that local is a public sector local, and we had to live through the Harris v. Quinn Supreme Court decision that Jane just told you about. And its effect on our 10,000 child care workers. So our child care workers were affected in the same way that home care workers were affected by that decision. We then had to deal with preparing for the Friedrichs case for the rest of our membership prior to the death of Justice Scalia. So what I'm going to tell you about is what we learned on those campaigns. And let's see if I can click this. There we go. I just want to start, though, with a quick quote from a leader that I worked with on these campaigns, and I think it sums up sort of where how we are feeling in the American labor movement right now. It says, we need a new path, a new playbook. Quote, no matter how strong and effective we may have been in the past, we can't continue on the same path. The rules are changing, and we need a new playbook. So let me tell you about our experience with Harris v. Quinn, what we did and what we learned. And as James said, this decision eliminated our right to fair share fees from our 10,000 child care providers who had contracts with state governments. So first, we ran a massive fair share membership sign-up blitz. We talked to every worker throughout the state. These members are scattered throughout the state and asked them to join. It was actually pretty easy to get them to join when we found them because many hadn't actually been asked to join directly. And we got our membership up to 85%. We thought that when the court decision came down, the Harris decision came down, we would only lose those 15% of fair share payers right away. But wasn't exactly the case. We learned that we didn't talk to current members soon enough. What we didn't do is we didn't inoculate our current members against the anti-union forces who'd be trying to convince them to drop. We really underestimated the anti-union forces. Members were inundated with opportunities and requests to drop their membership by these right-wing anti-union folks after that court decision. And if they weren't really invested or connected to the union, they often dropped. We had two different bargaining units in child care. In one unit, our membership dropped to 75%, which isn't really bad, but we did lose 10% members. But in the other unit, we went to closer to 50%. And there are a lot of reasons for that we could talk about, but I will say, obviously, the Supreme Court decision was the key element. And we learned that sign-up just isn't enough, and that we have to get member leaders involved and do member leadership development. Those that were engaged or connected in some way to the union did not drop their membership despite constant attempts by the anti-union groups to get them to do so. So that's the good news. So I want to tell you a little bit about what to expect from the anti-union forces. You may have heard these horror stories, but I'll tell you ours. So I will say in Washington State, before I get to the mail, the Washington State, we had an anti-union group called the Freedom Foundation. And once they won the Harris v. Quinn Supreme Court decision, they were going to make sure that folks dropped. They did everything to reach out to our members and encourage them. They attacked the union, and they helped them drop. Here's what they did. They sent mail to our members. They did email. They sent emails to our members with drop links. They did ads on the radio. They got lots and lots of free press about this issue. They made phone calls to our members telling them how they can drop. And most importantly, they went to people's houses and knocked on their doors throughout the state of Washington and said, sign here, drop your membership. So, I mean, the story goes on, and I will, you know, for those of you who get to come to Chicago, we'll talk more about this. But it's pretty amazing, and I think we weren't ready for it. I did want to share with you one little anti-union event that went on. Early on, they sent this Christmas card to our members, and it says, this Christmas, give yourself a raise. And if you can read closely, it says, thanks to a recent Supreme Court ruling, you no longer have to pay union dues to SEIU 925 if you don't want to. But unless you object, the state will automatically deduct up to $1,000 a year, not true, way too much, directly from your working connections reimbursement. By completing the enclosed form, blah, 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 mail it, you can drop. And then they send you to a website, SEIUoptout.com. This is really just the beginning of what they did, and I think it's pretty insidious, and you need to be ready for this stuff on a big scale. So after that experience, we knew Friedrichs was coming, and that the rest of our members, about half of all SEIU members in the country, would be affected by Friedrichs. And so we went into full gear, and I'll run through a list of things that we did and focused on. We did member leadership development. We got members involved very early and actively involved in that campaign. We did a sign-up campaign for fair share payers the way we did under Harris. We had conversations with all of our members and asked them to recommit and did inoculation about what was happening. We improved our communications and messaging. We did a lot of administrative work to get on top of our lists and our data. We changed the role of staff. Staff really had to refocus on this leadership development and this work ahead. And we really had to strengthen our community partnerships because in this just really, really difficult political climate, we cannot do this alone. So let me just talk about four of those elements and remind people that this is incredibly urgent. Now that we know that the threat and the attacks are back, that they're coming, we hope that everyone who cares about our union will feel the need to act and understand the urgency. And I think the place to start are in these four areas I'm going to walk through with you. Employee data, member leadership development, broad member engagement, and new hire recruitment. So employee data. Audit your membership list and dues. Make sure that you got everybody on your list. We had this story of a very big SEIU local that once they did that, they found 1,000 members who had slipped through the cracks and weren't paying dues. Identify who your fair share payers are and begin to think about who are potential member leaders in this fight. Make sure you have contact information for all members, if you don't already, that they're current and updated. Email, phone, text approval. Work address, social media, home address, all of this stuff is going to be incredibly important. Map your membership if you haven't already. Know where they all are in their workplaces, who their closest steward or worksite leader is, what their attitude is to the union. You're going to need to know all of this for a sign-up campaign. And I would say if your database system is old and rickety, now's the time to upgrade while you can afford it. Member leadership development. So member leaders really need, as I said, to be involved from the beginning of planning this effort. They need to know what's at stake. They need to feel ownership of their union. Member leaders need to learn about what's going to happen, and they need to evaluate what it means to their power and their ability to win and represent their members. And they need to help you make a plan, or make, help us all make a plan to take action and make tough decisions about what needs to change. So developing new leaders throughout will become a really high priority. And member roles should be strengthened around organizing. Provide training and support to make sure that your members know how to talk about this issue with other members and non-members. Ask them to join and get them involved. This is going to be key to the strength and survival of your union after open shop happens. Staff, as I said earlier, really need to be focused on leadership development and member engagement. And use any campaigns, your contract campaigns, grievance issues, and the sign-up effort to get more members involved. So broad member outreach, the third component, is really your sign-up campaign. It's talk to every member and ask for them to recommit to the union and to a new level of activity. Talk to every fair share payer and ask them to join. And get your message right about worker. This is about worker strength to win what members care about, and it's not about the union losing dues. And you have to talk to people about who's behind this. I mean, it's Wall Street, it's Right to Work Foundations, it's Walmart, Walton's. They want to be sure workers have less rights and no power. They're behind these Supreme Court decisions, cases, and they have everything to gain from this. And finally, I just want to talk about the importance of new hire recruitment. It becomes incredibly important in the world. In our childcare world now that's open shop, the new hire recruitment is just critical to keeping our membership up. This is our best opportunity to engage workers from day one. So if you currently have new employee orientations, just take a look and evaluate them. Are they inspiring? Do members deliver them? Do you get the majority signed up? And if you don't have new employee orientations, figure out how to do them. Get it in your next contract, but don't wait. Look at your new hire sign-up systems. Evaluate those. If the employer gives cards to members, which, you know, in my world that happened a lot, the employers gave people cards when they just got hired, take that back and make sure that the employee's first contact is with another union member. Think about how your sign-up and your materials have to change after open shop happens. Make sure the second conversation that they have after their orientation is with a steward or other members in the work site and that they're following up with folks. And make sure new employees get involved early. Social events, mentors, one-on-one lunches, invite folks right away to activities, and build relationships. It really has proven to be the best way to get to folks quickly and get them to join the union right away and to keep our membership numbers up. So I just want to run through a list of other things that we learned to do. I'll go through this quickly without a lot of detail, and hopefully we can talk more about it if you want to know more about it. We have get contract language that helps you prepare for right to work, like on new employee orientations and access to members. Talk to employers. If you have some friendly employers, work with them now and talk with them about what you're going to do as this is coming down the path. We pursued new sign-up methods like voice authorization or electronic authorization. If you can't get face-to-face with every member to have them sign a card, there are new ways to sign them up electronically and by phone. So I hate to throw this in the mix, but prepare for the possible loss of dues deduction. I don't know if there's anybody on the phone from Wisconsin or Michigan, but you know what this feels like. When you lose payroll deduction, it is massively difficult to get people to keep their membership. And you all are figuring out ways to make sure that you can get folks to pay dues through bank deduction, I think, and through credit cards. As I said earlier, deepen your labor and community partnerships. We need each other more than ever now. If you're in a good, friendly state with good legislators, you try to pass state or local legislation to prepare for right to work. I'm assuming people have started to think about your budgets. You need to assume that in about a year you will lose your fair share payers and some percentage of your members. So think ahead of time now about what you expect and what does that mean, where are you going to cut. And then finally, I would just say make sure that you're creating new systems of accountability. We all have a role in this. We all need to be accountable to each other constantly to be focused on building our union and our strength. And think about changing how we do our work for this new reality. So I just want to end with a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I bet you all have seen this. It reminds me that I need to feel inspired and that this fight is a righteous one. He says, quote, "In our glorious fight for civil rights, we must guard against being fooled by false slogans such as right to work. It's a law to rob us of our civil rights and job rights. Its purpose is to destroy labor unions and the freedom of collective bargaining by which unions have improved wages and working conditions of everyone." So that's where I'll end, and we'll open it up to questions.
Great, thank you. We have several, so we're going to start here. We have a question. Has not the NLRB challenged electronic signing of cards?
I don't know if the NLRB has challenged that. We have in our state, I don't know if there's a challenge, but in our state we've managed to get it in all of our contracts with employers. And I think our lawyers were pretty clear, at least in our state, that we had the right to do that. So I guess maybe we'll ask Jane to double check that for us.
Yeah, Jane, do you know if that's now, or do you need to look into it? Or?
Jane.
I think she's still on the phone.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the NLRB's position on electronic signing. So I would have to look at that.
Okay. We will look into that get the information out to everyone. We have another question that says, I represent public section members in New Jersey. What would happen if we do not have the majority of members paying full dues? Can the employer claim that we do not have the majority and therefore they don't have to bargain with us? That's a Jane question too, I think.
No, I don't think he could challenge the majority status of the union's representation because they're still members. They're just fair agency fee payers. So it's not a question of whether they're members. They're just agency fee payer members. Now, just to, I guess, make the terms a little clearer, agency fee is the fee that is for collective bargaining purposes and representational purposes only. And most unions do have public sector unions because of the case law that required or prohibited the union from charging for political activities. Most public sector unions have a procedure by which the representational portion of the dues is set in advance each year, and then a dissenter or a person who doesn't want to pay those amounts would be able to opt out. So I don't think, I haven't seen any case law anyway that would allow a public sector employer to say, because you have more agency fee payers or a majority are agency fee payers, you're not the majority representative.
Great, thank you.
And can I just add that if you're in a right to work state, I think you have probably examples, and we have plenty of examples of people who have less than majority membership, like 30% membership, but they still have exclusive representation, so they have not been challenged in that.
Okay. We have another question for Jane. What is timing for the appointment of a ninth justice on the Supreme Court?
Okay. It's a little difficult because it's probably going to be controlled by by Mitch McConnell as the Senate Majority Leader. I have heard him say that it's something on the top of their priority list, and he talked about doing this in a couple months. But obviously now that they've unveiled their bill to gut the Affordable Care Act, a lot of attention is going to be paid to that. The part of the issue is that at the present time, there's still a 60-vote filibuster rule that applies to the Supreme Court nominees. It was taken away for most cabinet appointments, as we know, by last year because Obama's could not get through and Harry Reid decided he had to do that. But at the present time, it's still a 60-vote filibuster rule. So there is a possibility that someone as conservative as Judge Gorsuch could be filibustered, but Mitch McConnell has also threatened to use the nuclear option on that and just take out the filibuster rule. So I would expect that a ninth justice would be on the Supreme Court by the time the October term starts, which is, October of 2017.
Okay. To keep on with the court, we have another question. If a ruling came down from the Supreme Court saying no to agency fees, does that ruling take effect right away, or will it take effect when the contract expires and opens for negotiations?
Well, if the Supreme Court decided that that fair share arrangements were unconstitutional, it would take effect immediately. And the unions would have to stop implementing their fair share agreements. The issues obviously would relate to whether there would be any reimbursement for time periods prior to the court decision. But once that decision comes down, there's really nothing left to do except for unions to implement it.
Thank you. Okay, we have a question for Kim. If you have if you're a local union with limited resources and limited money, what would be the number one most important thing you could do to meet these challenges?
I would say the number one thing to do is have a really effective new employee orientation and make sure that you are signing up every single new employee or as many as possible the minute they get hired.
Great. I want to tell everybody a little bit about the resources that the International has to help with this. We're developing now a website toolbox for organizing. It's going to be up soon with all the kinds of materials that you would need, from flyers to a sample sign-up cards to, you know, all different pieces of materials that you're going to need, and sort of a how-to approach some of these things. So in the coming months, that's going to be on our toolbox on the OPIU website. Kim also mentioned during her presentation about reaching out to people via text, getting permission. You know, we have a service here through the International that local unions can take advantage of for texting. It's under the umbrella of the International, so the rates are extremely low to almost nothing. If you want to jump on that system with us, you just let us know. We also have mass emailing capabilities, so that if you need, to email just your membership, we can do that as well. We can help with that. So there are a lot of resources here at the International that we want you to be aware of, and if you have questions about them or are in need, please, you know, make sure you call my office. I don't see any other questions. If anybody, you know, have any questions, now's the time. If you don't type them or don't get them in now, again, you can always email them to me, and we'll be sure to answer them. We had limited time today, and we kind of barely scratched the surface of what we want to talk about. So we're really thinking of this as a precursor to this training in Chicago, and happily, the majority of you have signed up, so we're excited about that. We want to encourage you, if you haven't already, to please do let us know if you're going to be able to come to Chicago. It's going to be a much more in-depth look at this with a lot of hands-on exercises so that you can really get in there and work this stuff through and feel comfortable being able to implement it at your local level. Training is going to begin on April 11th at 3 o'clock. Then we're going to have a dinner and then start first thing again the next day. If you haven't made your arrangements, please remember to reach out to Suzanne Fennick of my office to make those arrangements and to register. I guess that's it. We don't see any other additional questions. Check your inbox. You're going to get your PowerPoint this afternoon. And, again, you can always call or email us with any questions. We really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. Oh, and you know what? I do want to make the point real quick before I go that the International, I think you all know, but that the International is going to pay for one person to come to Chicago from your local. So please don't leave that opportunity on the table. Take advantage of it. Make sure that you send someone. So I think that's it. If any of the presenters have anything else? No? I thought I heard something. Okay,
oh,
terrific.
Actually, this, oh.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, this is
go ahead.
I was just going to echo Kim's comment about the importance of new member orientation. And, you know, if anyone on the phone wants some assistance in putting together a plan, because each local union is going to have a unique plan that's going to be particular to your membership and the geography and all the other factors. But do let me know. Come to the trainings for sure. But I'd be happy to work with your local as well as, you know, involving our organizing staff.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you. I just did have one more question that came through. How will the payment work for the individual to go to Chicago? If you call Suzanne, what's going to happen is we'll just take the name of or names of who you're planning to send to Chicago. We'll make all the reservations at the hotel. But the one that we're paying for, we'll take care of. If you send others, just be prepared when they get to the hotel that they're going to have to put a credit card down for their room. For flights, that can be handled through our travel agency. Talk with Suzanne and all of that can be taken care of. Okay. Now I do think we're finished. Like I said, though, we're always here if you want to call or email about anything. And we look forward to seeing you all in Chicago. Thanks so much.